And this is the WERU News Report for Tuesday, September 4th, 2012. I'm Amy Brown. Well-known international peace activist and author Kathy Kelly spoke in Bangor on August 23rd after returning from one of her many trips to Afghanistan. She talked about the work of the Afghan peace volunteers and day-to-day life under the shadow of the ongoing U.S. military presence in that country. Today we pick up where we left off last week on the news report with the final segment of Kathy Kelly's talk at her stop in Bangor.
This is a map that was designed by a CIA analyst who was asked to create a map that would show the area in terms of borders that would serve United States national interests. So the left-hand map shows the real borders. Here are all the stands up in the north, and there's that long border with China and Pakistan, the Iran-Pakistan border. But the analyst imagined a map, this is imaginary, in which the whole area of Baluchistan, this is close to the size of Texas, would break away from Afghanistan and become free Baluchistan, which is, it's not unimaginable. The Baluchis are always fighting against a very repressive Pakistani government. And then the Afghan border with China, instead of being a small sliver, would become quite large and curve over and cut off Pakistan's border with China. And then the area where the nuclear weapons are would also become part of Afghanistan. And what I can tell you is that when I was in Pakistan in 2009 and 2010, I speak no Urdu, I speak no Hindi, I could only speak with English-speaking, generally well-to-do and educated Pakistanis. Every Pakistani person in that category that I spoke with had seen this map and felt that this would likely be their future. At first it appeared in 2006 in the New York Times, and that it was not a new concept. And then this map might be called Pipelineistan. This is the Caspian Sea Basin here, very, very endowed with natural gas and fossil fuels, an extremely rich basin. And UNICAL, back in the 90s, had started a pipeline that would go from the Caspian Sea Basin across Afghanistan, across Pakistan, and over to India. And then it got kind of truncated. But when the NATO forces met in Lisbon in 2010, the Asia Development Bank said, okay, we'll underwrite, we'll pay for the expenses for construction of the pipeline. So the NATO countries, the 49 countries that are in Afghanistan, were exultant. They were thrilled at the idea that this pipeline could be constructed and the United States would have more than half the shares. So when we ask ourselves, why does the United States want 450 forward operating bases across Afghanistan and three huge prisons, and why will the world's largest embassy now be located in Kabul, I think it may have to do with a desire to control the pricing and the flow of resources like natural gas, fossil fuels, and minerals that might be found under the ground in Afghanistan, and be able to say to China and to Russia and to Iran and to Pakistan, the United States has a strong militarized presence here. So when you hear that the United States troops are coming home, please keep in mind that the agreement that President Karzai signed on May 1st with President Obama will keep the special forces, the Navy SEALs, the Marine Rangers, the Green Berets, and the bases in Afghanistan until 2024 or beyond. So it's simply not true that the war is ending, because the Taliban have made it so clear, as long as you stay, we stay. And it looks as though the killing would likely continue. I am deeply moved by Wilfred Owen's writing. He's the poet who died in the trenches in World War I. And he had begun to see the utter futility and horror and folly of the war. And he likened it to something from the Old Testament scriptures, Father Abraham taking his son Isaac and binding the son after the son had gone and gathered the wood to make his own funeral pyre. And Isaac is taken up the mountainside because Abraham believes he's doing the will of the God to sacrifice his son. and he has the knife in his hand, and he's ready to bring the knife down and kill his own son when the angel of the Lord says, lay not thy hand upon the lad. Lay not thy hand upon the lad. Lay not thy hand upon the youngsters being sent off to fight the wars. Lay not thy hand upon the youngsters who are poor and don't have other choices and join militaries. Lay not thy hand upon the young children of Afghanistan who are sometimes starving to death. The angel of the Lord says, lay not thy hand upon the lad. See in the thicket a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. And the old man would not so. Imagine Flanders Field, huh? The old man would not so and slew the son and half the seed of Europe one by one. And so I ask myself, what is that ram of pride that we could offer up instead? And I think that we are rightfully proud that as a country, this is a nation that loves its children and loves its grandchildren and wants to take good care of the children and the grandchildren. But part of the care for those children and grandchildren is going to mean all of us shouldering our very, very adult responsibilities to confront the United States military, which is almost like what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King likened to a demonic suction cup, taking up all of the resources, what's left. What's left to deal with environmental troubles and with infrastructure troubles and with the education problems and healthcare problems here in this country? I mean, we could be doing it. We could be retrofitting the housing stock all across the country to make it energy passive and solar neutral. We could be building the mass transit systems in every major urban area. We could be creating so many jobs, but the military right now is, as Dwight Eisenhower warned us, 3 days before he ended his presidency, he said, beware of the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial, he actually said military-industrial congressional complex, and Scoop Jackson said, you better take that Congress out of that phrase. And now, of course, we have the prison-industrial complex and all of the jobs that are associated with so-called security, including the lawyers that lock people up. So this is almost like a vice-like grip on our economy. What is to be done? I think there's a great deal to learn from Tahrir Square. You know, I'm so glad to know about the vigils that continue for 10 years, and I know that people have gone the extra mile forming community and sustaining community. But something I'm so impressed by with Tahrir Square, I know that story isn't over yet, but people didn't go away. They went out and they stayed and they stayed, and in spite of military attacks, in spite of grave dangers, they held their ground. And I think that this is something that we can all imagine together. What can we be like if we agree that, you know, they can take the flowers away, but they can't prevent the springtime? And the springtime of our sense of taking on the adult responsibilities is quite wonderful. That Occupy logo, 99 and 1, within 12 weeks became globalized. And who knows what will come about in the future as we ask, what kinds of products do we want to make? What kinds of work do we want to do? And reclaim the kind of a world where the children and the grandchildren, both in Afghanistan and here in the United States, can thrive. So thank you so very much for thinking about matters of madness and sanity, of hope and rationality, and I'll certainly bring your goodwill back to Afghanistan. I hope to go there on September 26th and get a one-month visa. And if you'd ever like to be in touch with these youngsters, every month on the 21st, they do a phone call. You could go to globaldaysoflistening.com and get in on the phone call. That's a way to hear from them directly. And I also want to wish all of you a safe home. And if you have any questions, thoughts, ideas, announcements, this would, I think, be a good time.
This is international peace activist and author Kathy Kelly speaking in Bangor on August 23rd after returning from one of her many trips to Afghanistan. A question and answer session followed, with the first question being about Greg Mortensen's book, Three Cups of Tea, and the work he and others are doing in the country.
There are many, many NGOs that have started projects in Afghanistan. Some are criticized for not being sustainable, that if the NGO goes, the project won't persist. Certainly, Greg Mortensen built more schools than I did. One thing that occurred to me, he was criticized. Somebody said they went to see a school that he had built, and it was being used as a place to store spinach. But actually, if you're out in a rural area and the kids are on vacation for 5 or 6 months and you've got your spinach harvest and you want to put it someplace, put it in the school. I mean, that's not all that unusual. But I think that he maybe wasn't very well served by a ghostwriter who did some exaggeration on a few things. And I know that Loyola Academy in my area in Chicago wanted him to come very much as a speaker. And they were a bit distressed because the going rate, I think, was $30,000 for a one-hour talk, and he had to be picked up in a limo and housed in a five-story hotel along with three of his traveling companions. So, you know, when you see that dire, abject poverty, I think that sense of compensation seems a little curious. But the last time that he had come into Afghanistan, at least that I know of, was March of 2011. And it happened that on the day that he arrived, a large team of ours from the United States came. And when they got into the airport, the electricity went out. And now, can you imagine, you know, you're trying to find your bags and it's pitch black. So he did what he did under circumstances that were not easy in terms of building anything, with electricity shortages and the water is bad and the highest fecal content of the air anywhere on the earth is in Kabul. And it's not a user-friendly place to try and finish a project. So I think it is amazing that in northern Afghanistan he created schools and villages that could sustain the schools, and also in Pakistan.
Thank you. A speaker come here a few years ago. I don't know who else in this room was there, but it was up at the church up here on Park Street, and she was from Afghanistan, and she said they needed wells. She said that when the Soviet Union had come in, they had destroyed, I don't know if they're not aqueducts, but it was some way that
aquifers,
the melting snows, you know, down into the lower elevation so that they could water their crops. And she said everything was drying. They're trying to build wells, and I didn't know if you were familiar with that program.
Mm.
Her name was Miriam
Akuka.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's
Miriam.
She's doing a project with planting trees.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, well, this is this Alfred McCoy's idea that it would cost the $34 billion to reseed the orchards. And the Soviets had cut down and of course that then creates tremendous erosion when you cut down all the trees. And then you can't blame poor people who want fuel, and so they go and scavenge still further. So the mountains look like, you know, the side of a camel or something. But it would be possible to reseed the orchards and to rebuild the irrigation systems. And Afghanistan has had traditionally an agricultural-based economy. Unfortunately, many of the NGOs have been more office-based, and so people want jobs working in offices. But I am hoping that the Afghan Peace Volunteers will team up with people doing community gardens and, understanding agronomy and go back and start to help with some of that reconstruction.
So these types of movements, if you will, would be very good for the people there.
Oh, I think anything that can help restore the agricultural economy can be good.
This person, didn't she say something about a lot of people had turned to growing opium?
Yes.
Because they had no alternative?
Well, it certainly is a more lucrative crop, and the Taliban, when they came into power, actually eradicated opium production. Now, they weren't quite choir boys about this. They had taken all of the opium that was in existence and stored it, and the price went sky high. People on the streets of Philadelphia and the opium distributing or mixing baking soda trying to, you know, pretend that they had opium that they were giving out. And so the Taliban made a lot of money off of that. But it probably would be possible to once again eradicate the poppy crop. But if it's done through fumigation and spraying and military tactics, then I think you'll find fighting back.
I don't mean to belabor the point, but it's just that sometimes you support things and you think it's going to help the indigenous people, the people of that area, and you're just being ethnocentric, if you will. You know, you're imposing your viewpoint of what's right and what is going to benefit them, and you actually make things worse. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was asking.
Uh-huh. Well, I loved an evening when the Afghan peace volunteers were on the phone with Noam Chomsky for 35 minutes. He really likes these kids. And Gulamai, the youngest, asked him, what do you think about the United States paying reparations? And Noam Chomsky said, oh, that's a very good idea. He said, that's exactly what a civilized nation would do. So I would say there are 38 United Nations agencies operating in Afghanistan. There's not one of those agencies that I would think, oh, close that down. You know, when you think of the World Food Program, the demining efforts, the efforts to help people who become new refugees. If there were reparations paid, under whose auspices would the reparations be spent? The Karzai government is riddled with corruption. He's got warlords and drug lords. Every single ministry is being run by a bona fide warlord. So I certainly don't have all the answers there. What I can tell you is that Voices goes over and listens. We sit and we listen and we watch and we pay the rent for the apartment and we try to study Dari and get to know these kids as best we can. But I certainly don't feel like we have a right to be prescriptive.
What do we actually do about it, though?
Well,
I know a lot of people my age are just about ready to start burning things down, so I've thought about it, and, you know, it seems to be the only thing that might actually do something someday, so I kind of wonder, like, short of burning things down, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to hear vote.
Thank you.
I'm gonna vote for the lesser of two evils, but other than voting, like something that might actually impact a completely corrupt, bought-out government here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a tall order. I haven't paid my taxes since 1980. I wouldn't give them a dime, ever. I've seen too much of war. I will never, ever pay for a weapon. I won't pay for blowing a child's body apart. I won't pay for any of the works of war. That money can go toward much better things. So you're young, and you could think about that. You know, find yourself employment that wouldn't involve paying money into federal income tax. So just in your own personal life, you could chart a course of civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience every day of your life. For most people, it's impossible. It's simply not. But I maybe left one job when I kind of look at the IRS as my spiritual director. So that's one thing to think about. I think that it's important to educate the U.S. public, trying to overcome this notion of a humanitarian war, and that can be done by listening to people from Afghanistan. That's why I like to try to get the voice of these Afghan peace volunteers out. And we've been very grateful to people who will go over to Kabul and spend a month living with them. It's not the safest spot in the world, but that's another action that can be done. I think it's great, especially when you're at a young age, to learn another language. Just start learning Dari, and in a year you'd have it mastered. And then you're much better able to converse and to be of service. I think it probably is a good idea to go to the offices of elected representatives, to your senators, to your congresspeople, and let them know exactly how you feel. At least let it be known. Assemble peaceably inside their offices and let them know what your beliefs are about the war and whether or not you would ever want to see somebody in elected office continue to support that war. And tell them about Barbara Lee's bill, H.R. 270, which asks that the troops be brought home. I think it's a good idea to be in touch with the people who have positions of leadership in the local community, the people who are putting out the newspaper, the people who our leaders at the university level, the people who are faith-based leaders, and just constantly ask them, will you speak out about this war? What about people in Afghanistan who have meant us no harm, who are bearing the brunt of this warfare? Will you post this picture? Will you put this in your bulletin? Will you begin a course about Afghanistan? Just keep on pressuring people. Make a nuisance of yourself. I think that it's important to listen to Democracy Now. It's a very good news presentation. Amy Goodman, she gives very fair coverage and thorough coverage to a lot of these issues. So maybe it would be possible to have a weekly gathering of people who come together to sort through issues about new books that have been produced or news that's come forward, and just keep on trying to have a club of people that are educating themselves and staying on top of the issues regarding Afghanistan.
Try to get the Bangor Daily News to publish Amy Goodman's column.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be very good. And come to Chicago and work with us.
So I've been to college, and I understand what you just said. 99% of my friends have not been to college and would have missed about 50% of your vocabulary just then.
Ah.
So those are the people I'm worried about. All the people that went to college in this room, I would get measured, you know, 4-year college degrees and up in this room right now. Just a general guess. That is not most people.
Yeah.
None of those things are going to work on those guys. And that, I think that's the problem.
But how did the Occupy movement...
I went to the Occupy movement, and it was the same kind of folks I see in this room here.
Yeah, these are the people that graduate.
I'm not trying to be harsh. I mean, it definitely brought in more young people and more angry people, but, I mean, they're not still going to those meetings.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Maybe I'm being overly harsh and cynical. Uh-huh. I don't know.
Well, who would have guessed that the Occupy was going to happen? I mean, I think that was unpredictable, and it wasn't being... orchestrated by anybody. It really had its a life of its own. I think we can't predict what's coming around the corner. We can try to be ready, but I really appreciate what you said about being able to speak to people who won't feel as though somehow they're being let me say that if you said, Kathy Kelly, I'll give you $500 if you can name the capital of every country in Africa, I'd have to watch that $500 go right past my nose. I can't do it. I know very little about the entire continent of Africa, to be honest. And so I'd have to start at the ground floor level. And so your friends who don't know anything much about Afghanistan would have to do the same thing. Now, why not do that? People can earn $129,000, the first $80,000 of it tax-free, going over to Afghanistan as a security contractor. And they probably know very little more than the friends you're talking about. And every time I travel over there, the plane is full of people who all look like they're wearing a certain kind of uniform. You know, they've got very strong muscles and tattoos and buzz haircuts and wristbands and the sunglasses. And they're going over to make a great deal of money in Afghanistan. Well, what about people caring about Afghanistan, not because they want to make money, but because we've made war against people harshly and seemingly almost endlessly. I wonder if some of the friends that you have might come together and be, you know, just be asked, would you want to care about, you know, show those videos. There are 100 more of them at this website.
Kathy, I got a bunch of questions written down. I'm blonde and brain damaged, so I have to write everything down. Oh, I was going to say about that gentleman's comment that he thought about all those people that were like people in this room with 4-year degrees. The reason for that, I think, is because a lot of those people that were in the Occupy movement were people that graduated college and couldn't find work. And I think they were really massively frustrated.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what you described was the point was really well taken about the United States becoming a power, you know, an established power in Afghanistan with across the minerals and the natural gas. This describes what I've heard called, it's not my term, but the Third World War, which the United States has been involved with all over the world. They go in and they create a humanitarian cause, fight against communism or whatever it is, and they monopolize the minerals and they monopolize the resources. I mean, look at Chile, South American countries, and Kenya, I think. But anyway, I'm not really sure, but that's going along with it. What I was curious about, a couple of things about Afghanistan. If I missed something, I'm very sorry, but what do you do when you go over there for a month? And how do they distinguish you from the American military presence? I know you're not wearing your little outfit, your little uniform, but and you have a much more beautiful smile than most of these military people, but your eyes are kind. But how do they take you?
Well, the seamstresses that come in, they love me. And the kids all love me, and so it's easy. I'm very happy to be there.
What do they perceive you as doing? What's your role there?
I wash dishes and I clean and I help cook and I listen and I study and I write quite a bit. That's all.
And your purpose is to establish goodwill between this country and...
Well, I would love to bring the Afghan peace volunteers over here and have them speak directly, but we can't get visas for them. It's just impossible. We've tried like crazy. So I would like to be a voice for them and show their videos and tell people about them and write about them. And that requires listening and, you know, picking up your pen. And I'm not very good with a camera, to be honest, but others are. And
as far as the winter in Kabul, and about Kabul, you described a place, I wrote it down, but I can't find it right now, but Helmand, the Helmand province.
Yeah.
How far, you know, you can look at that map, but, you know, as far as the size of, let's say, Kabul in relation to Bangor or Boston.
Kabul is a city of 5 million people now. It was built for 500,000, but it's absorbed so many refugees. But they've never been able to fix the sewage and sanitation to meet the needs of 5 million people. The south is where the Helmand province is. That would be about an 11-hour drive from
Kabul. So I was going to ask you, in where you are, you don't ever feel afraid of the drone or anything like that?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's never any cause for fear, but I do worry for these boys actually quite a bit. There was a big firefight that broke out 3 blocks away from where we live, and the security people called the NDS, the National Directorate of Security, have put out death threats, and they came to visit while I was there, and they were asking, who's she? And
wow.
So, yeah, I wouldn't say it's without anxiety, but... Well, you catch courage from one another.
Catch courage. Is there any kind of a military, the U.S. government's stance on what you're doing there? Do they think it's wonderful what you're doing? That's a serious question.
Yeah, no, I don't think they mind at all. I think, no.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
That was activist and author Kathy Kelly speaking in Bangor on August 23rd. Her talk was recorded by Matt Murphy. Parts 1 and 2 aired here on the WERU News Report last week. If you missed them, you can go to weru.org and find them in the Public Affairs Archive section. More information about Kathy Kelly's work is available at the website Voices for Creative Nonviolence. That's vcnv.org. We've also posted links to the Afghan peace volunteers and YouTube clips of the videos that were shown as part of this presentation on the WERU archives and on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WERUFM. That's the WERU News Report for Tuesday, September 4th, 2012. I'm Amy Brown. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. We've got Hightower coming up next, then Free Speech Radio News, Democracy Now!, and as always, a night of great music here on your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at weru.org.
Support for WERU comes from Quantum Insulators.